Yeah, good morning, North State, and welcome to Free Fire Radio and KCNR 1460. It's Carl and Linda Bott. Our phone line's here, 605-4567. Joined today by Bad Bob.
And good morning.
Hey, just turn me up just a little bit there, Bad Bob.
Yeah, a little more. There you go.
There you go. Now I can hear everything. You know, when you get a little bit older, those ears start to act funny. But you know what? My eyes are great. You know that? I can tell my eyes are working perfectly. I can look right next to me at this beautiful woman.
Well, good morning,
honey.
Good morning. It's 7:06 in the morning. If you're just tuning in, we're going to be taking your emails, Linda at KCNR1460.com. Currently 51 degrees, and I've lost my icon. Bob, you have to tell me because I have a Mac.
Which icon did you lose? There are several of them on any desktop.
Did we say icon or neuron? No, my icon, my Safari icon.
Ah, your browser. We'll take care of that during the break.
I'm sure. It's a quickie, and Bob is so computer rich with information. You guys are not going to want to go anywhere. I'm telling you, this is one of those days you're probably, if you listen to the show before you get ready for work, you probably just better call in now and say you're going to be late. You are not going to want to miss a moment of this morning's show. We have a historical event happening here this morning in the studio. And that, even though we always think every moment's a historical moment here, or hysterical.
Every moment on this station is historical. Everything is put in the archives for later on to be sent to the Smithsonian, put in time capsules. But we have to make a couple announcements. The first, the largest announcement, though, is our debate that was going on Friday between Shasta County District Attorney Jerry Benito and Challenger Steve Carlton has been put off till April 23rd. Been put off till April 23rd. Our guest Friday will be Jim Nielsen. Somewhat of a confusion in times for all three of us, and so it was just been put off for a couple weeks. It's still going to be at Tobacco and Brew. Still going to be for 90 minutes, and their last debate, from what I understand, lasted about 45 minutes. We're going to have twice that length of time, and we're going to be able to put in a lot more and have this, and we can advertise it out more to get people down there, too. Not that there would have been any problems. We always have a lot of people down in our town hall meetings. But, again, we're postponing, not canceling. We're postponing the debate from this Friday between Jerry Benito and Steve Carlton to April 23rd, a Friday.
Now, we also want you to remember, too, today, this morning, actually, if you're hearing gunshot, lots of them, it's because the Asphalt Cowboys are out and about, and they're going to be shooting from the truck.
And selling tickets.
As they round up, go around the town, and that's going to be a really good time. We went to the clubhouse yesterday with the Reading Rodeo, and that's going to happen in May. And, boy, they have really got a big week set up. You know, of course, we're going to be giving tickets away for the breakfast and the pancake breakfast. I think they're expecting to serve 14,000 this year. Well, no, it was 10,000 last year.
They'd like to serve 11,000, a break record.
Where did I hear 14? Or was I chomping on a salad or something?
Chomping on salad there. But what it is... we're going to have a number of events that we're going to be talking about during the week of the rodeo, plus the week before the rodeo. We're going to be having guests in here anywhere from bullfighters to bull riders to the clowns to rodeo promoters, just to give everybody a good idea just what rodeo is. We're going to have the first... That's on our scope a few weeks away. On our scope, the closest, however, is Cool April Nights. And that's going to be rocking and rolling here next week.
Well, April 15th, we don't want you to forget that we started off by going out to Anselmo Vineyards for their wine, dine.
Show and shine.
Show, shine, wine, and dine. And that begins at 11 o'clock, from what I understand. 50 cars will be there, and they have some waiting.
Yeah, they've turned away 10.
That's really exciting. And there's going to be shakes and hamburgers and fries. Double Take is going to be playing, and the lovely Beverly D'Angelo will be out there at 3 o'clock with her group. Then we don't want you to forget, on Friday night, the night after at the Great Anselmo Vineyards, we are going to be out there doing music, myself and Rick Hill and Pat Karch. And we're going to have cigars, and it's going to be like a cigar jazz wine night.
Yeah, you have to remember, too, is that on Thursday they're having Bo Hopkins and
Paul Amat
from American Graffiti and a couple of cars from there. And then Paul and Bo are going to be down. They're going to be doing the big cruise on Friday, and then coming back right after the cruise back up to Anselmo. So you can, rub elbows with them and smoke a cigar.
We have a bunch of people in the lobby that we're going to bring through the door here, and we're going to talk about something that's really fun going on in town.
Yeah. Our guest today, is beginning at 7:30, is Colonel Tim Garrity, who was the commander of the 24th Marine Amphibious Unit on October 23rd, 1983, when they were attacked in Beirut. And we're going to be talking about that with the colonel. Plus, what impact did that have on our foreign policy? And are we still suffering from decisions made at that point? But before we get to the colonel, we're going to be talking to some local actors, and they're going to roll in here right after this break.
Listen up! Oh, and Linda Bach on KCNR 1460 AM, clearly News Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Free Fire Radio. It's Carl and Linda Bott. Phone line's here, 605-4567 right here at Free Fire Radio. We're streaming at KCNR1460.com for your family and friends that may be someplace in Romania.
Pongo Pongo.
There, too.
Oh, by the way, it is April 7th. What happened to March? April 7th, beautiful day out, currently 51 degrees. This is the day if you're going to take the walk. Or go to the doggy park or whatever you do where you can stretch your limbs. This is, currently 51 degrees. We have this great studio full of all these gifted, talented actors.
Yeah, Bob and I kind of feel out of place there. Yeah. Okay.
Laughter in the morning. Don't you like waking up to the laughter?
Okay, our guest list is a cast of thousands are waiting out here. Yeah, but, of course, in our stupendous studios, we can put 430 people in here easily. Donna Stolpe, who is the director of a play that's going to be coming this weekend called The Dining Room by A.R. Gurney. And she is accompanied by, and I'm just doing first names, Marilyn, Adrian, Karen, and this very lucky guy named Lyle. Yeah, he's over there dancing in the street. Okay, Donna, tell us about this play.
Well, thank you very much, Linda and Carl, for having us on. We open Friday night. It's The Dining Room by A.R. Gurney. Six very talented actors, three women, three men, playing 57 different parts. It's 18 vignettes, and it's about the decline of the WASP family, the white Anglo-Saxon Protestant family. And the play takes place between about 1920 and the 1980s, and it all centers around a dining room.
Oh. How many personnel? How many characters? 50.
57, right, guys?
So
each
does that mean
one is playing about eight characters?
So yeah. Was that hard when you guys were when you read the script and you had to study your parts? How did you compartmentalize that?
Go ahead, Marilyn. Tell us, how did you do that?
No. It's interesting because not all the parts are adult parts. So you compartmentize a little old lady and a six-year-old.
Wow. And so do you have to, as the light is shining on you, do you transform from, like, say, that character, the older lady, to the child?
We certainly hope so.
So the magic of just facial expression, just, as the story, you have to really be, I'm sure, centered into the story to see what happens. Because I can imagine what the journey, not just for the audience, but for the actor, the physical and the emotional journey to you know, transform like that. But so what is it like with a matter of seconds that you go from the character to the other character, or is there somebody narrating?
Sometimes. No, usually you walk off, you'll walk off stage, but it might just be for 5 or 10 seconds, and you turn right back on as a different character. So, but as an actor, it's lots of fun to get to do so many different parts in one play.
Is it difficult to keep the characters in order? I mean, if I'm watching the play, and you walk off the stage as a 6-year-old, and you come back on as an 80-year-old. I mean, is there a transition there so Carl doesn't get completely confused with what's going on here?
Well, we have simple costume changes like a scarf or a hat or a sweater or something to
tell us that something's happened.
Something's and hopefully okay. By the demeanor of the character, you'd be able to tell.
Okay, so it's called The Dining Room, and tell us where we get tickets, when does it start, how long's the run?
Okay, it will open Friday at 7:30. We're at 1905 Hartnell at the Center for Spiritual Living. So we run Friday the 9th, Saturday the 10th. We do a matinee. That's Friday and Saturdays are at 7:30. Our matinee is on Sundays at 3 o'clock. And so we'll be running also the 16th, 17th, and 18th. So that's the 9th, 10th, 11th, and the 16th, 17th, and 18th.
So that's
six performances.
Wonderful run.
Yes.
That is great. I know how it feels when you work so hard to get one night for a concert. So that's great. Now, Donna, how did you choose this play, and how did you put together your ensemble?
Okay. I look at the size of the stage that we're working with, and of course the labor involved. So this is one set, which is wonderful, and this I think is very pertinent to what is going on in today's time. So it kind of brings us back to times when we made those decisions around a dining room table, when a family, when that was like the important thing to do. And so we kind of see the decline of that happening. There are moments in the play that the emotions, a lot of comedy, but we also have, like Marilyn's, one of her characters is suffering from dementia. So we have that. We have a character that is planning his own funeral. We have these delightful actors acting like 6-year-olds at a birthday party. So there's a lot of social value. So and A.R. Gurney is the one who wrote Love Letters. And so the play is very poignant. And William Macy was in this play, I think, in about 1982. And it's Gurney's writing is incredible. And every time I read this play, there's something new that kind of jumps out, don't you? Yeah.
All right. So The Dining Room, catch it this Friday at the Spiritual Enrichment Center on Hartnell, right?
Yes.
And what time does it begin?
Okay, it's at 7:30.
Okay, 7:30. Yeah. Now, I understand that you have a little packet there in your hands, and you're going to give away some tickets this morning.
That's right. I don't know how your venue works, if you have call-in guests.
We'll have 605-4567. If you call the hotline now, the first two callers will get
Tickets for opening night.
Okay, there you go.
605-4567. We have to take a quick break here. Thanks very much for coming on and telling us about the play.
Thanks for
we love community theater.
And break
here.
A leg.
Thank you so much.
I always believe you that. You need to say that. Great guys. Thanks for being on.
Carl Lindebaugh, Free Fire Radio, Clearly News Talk Radio. Welcome back to Free Fire Radio, KCNR 1460. It's Carl and Linda Bott. Our phone line's here, 605-4567. Hey, you want free tickets to that play, give us a call, 605-4565. 605-4565. We've got, I think, four tickets there that we can give away. You know, we don't give away tickets a lot, but it seems like we have lately.
$10 value here, and it supports your local theater beginning this Friday.
You know, this portion of the show is brought to you by Cypress Square Barbershop. That's right, D.C. Tim and the Mysterious Haircutter, they're back. They're right down there off of Athens Street in the Cypress Square Barbershop. They are a non-frills barbershop. You're not going to find gel. You're not going to find hair dryers. You know, they give a good haircut. The lather around the ears, the shave around the ears. You have a manly atmosphere there. Yes, that's right, manly. And but you can still bring your son, send your son there. There's, I mean, you know, the it's a polite place. It's man's last stronghold. They have the shooting magazines, the car magazines, National Geographic. You know, I can't think of a better place to get your hair cut. And you don't have to worry about somebody coming up and asking if they can do a pedicure. I mean, I can just imagine that. It was hard enough listening to Rich Bay talk about his Vans.
Rich.
Cypress Square Barbershop.
Hey, while we're on the subject.
Man's last stronghold.
Speaking of pedicure, you're going to need one after you've walked a mile in her shoes.
Okay.
And we have to say thank you.
Oh, my gosh.
To many, many sponsors. We're still taking sponsors today. If you want to email us, you can email me.
We've collected
a little over $400. The goal was $250.
Yeah,
but
it's amazing how you can embarrass somebody on the radio and they come through.
Okay, we've got our tickets.
We gave away our tickets.
Okay, but anyway, talking about Saturday, at 10 o'clock is Walk a Mile in Her Shoes, of course, which is a fundraiser for men that are helping awareness against domestic violence at the shelter. And Carl is going to, first of all, somebody donated $100 yesterday if he would wear a boa, $100 if he would wear a hat, $50 if he would wear pearls, another $25, another $30, another $25, another $25, and then somebody for $101 because they're sorry that they can't walk with him. And so we're letting you know now that if you care to sponsor Carl, he will be wearing red pumps. And you know what? I think you might want to...
They're not red pumps.
Yes, they are. You wanted Dorothy slippers.
Those aren't pumps. What's a pump? It sounds bad. Bob, what's a pump?
Pumps.
When you wear a pump, what's it look like? Bob, so you're lying to me. I know you do.
He does not know what he's in for. He just, you know, it's going to be great, though. You're such a sport. But I think probably Friday night you better just put him on for just a quick, test drive. Bob, I'm sorry. You started to say something about your pump. Something's going on.
The only pumps I know about are dewatering devices.
Got it.
Okay, anyway, so we are taking more sponsors because, of course, you know that it is money for the Women's Refuge and women against for awareness against domestic violence. And this is the third year that they're doing it here, and they're doing it around the promenade. So you might even want to come and watch Carl and cheer him on.
Okay, now, we had an email the other day about the post-traumatic stress. And can you get a concealed carry permit if you have post-traumatic stress? I talked to the sheriff, had a face-to-face with him on this one, and he said, you know, it's like anything. Just because you have post-traumatic stress disorder does not mean that you are automatically disqualified from having a weapon or being able to carry a concealed weapon. And a lot of it has to do if you're on medications and the kind of medications, but that would be for any type of individual, whether you had post-traumatic stress or not. Many people have post-traumatic stress. It does not affect their lives to any extent where they would be disqualified from having that. So, Jim, I would do is talk to the sheriff or talk to his representative and just say, hey, look, I'm not on heavy meds. I'm not into this. Nothing that's going to alter my decision making and my equilibrium or anything like that. That's not what I got from the sheriff. Go down there and talk to him. I don't think you'll have a problem. Now, tomorrow, the Shasta Lake American Legion is going to have a spaghetti feed Thursday evening at the Veterans Hall on Yuba Street from 16:30, that's 4:30 to civilians, to 8 o'clock. This is an annual fundraiser for supporting the Veterans Community Service and their youth program. So, the Shasta Lake American Legion will be at the Veterans Hall on Yuba Street from 4:30 to 8 o'clock tomorrow on a fundraiser. Then there's spaghetti feed. I think we've gotten most of the notifications out. Now, our guest beginning at 7:30 right after this break will be Colonel Tim Garrity, former commander of the 24th Marine Amphibious Unit, the one that was attacked in Beirut. Colonel's going to talk about that, but he's also going to talk about the impact that blast, that attack, had on our country. It's Carl and the Bot, Free Fire Radio, KCNR 1460, clearly news talk radio. Welcome back to Free Fire Radio on KCNR 1460. It's Carl and Linda Botter. Phone lines here are 605-4567. We're streaming at KCNR1460.com. No matter where you go, you can run, but you can't hide. Send us emails to Linda at KCNR1460.com. We're honored today to have as our guest Colonel Tim Garrity, former commander of the 24th Marine Amphibious Unit that suffered, that was attacked by suicide bombers on October 23rd, 1983. Good morning, Colonel.
Good morning.
It's a pleasure having you here, and it's a pleasure getting to know you. You, of course, are known throughout the Marine Corps and as a fine commander, a great commander, and how your men feel about you that have worked with you. So I can just say it's an honor for us to have you here.
Yeah, thank you. It's my honor.
And, you know, the reason he's here is another inhabitant of the studio here is Reverge Anselmo. Good morning.
Good morning. It's Reverge. Hi, everybody.
Well, Reverge, you were there as a Marine, assigned to the MAL, if I understand right.
That's right. I was a corporal. I worked for Captain McCarthy, the S2 officer, which was the intel section of the headquarters element. Colonel Garrity was our second CO when we went back in our second tour, which turned out to be the hot tour. But just to introduce him more colorfully, when he took over, he was driving this. I remember this so well. His wife is very beautiful, and he had this huge fruit salad on his chest, and he was driving a sports car.
That means ribbons on right. his chest. Right. For people that may not understand that
fruit salad. Right. Okay.
But everybody used to call the colonel a get laid kind of guy. That's the first impression you had of him when you met him.
Okay.
He is handsome, by the way. Bob will be posting pictures. Go ahead. So anyway, when you met him in the car, he was driving.
No, I didn't meet the colonel. I was a corporal. I saw the colonel.
Oh, yeah.
You don't meet colonels. No. At certain ranks, you don't meet colonels until a colonel meets you. Mm-hmm. Tim, tell us about a little bit about yourself. You were a Vietnam veteran, and so tell our audience who you are.
I was born and raised in St. Louis. Seven kids, six boys and one girl. My education was totally Catholic. I had the Franciscans in grade school and parochial school, and I had the Christian Brothers. It's a military prep school, a junior ROTC in high school, and then I had the Jesuits at St. Louis University. So by the time I got to the Marine Corps, I was prepared.
I was going
to
say that the Marine Corps was probably a little bit easier after that, wasn't it?
It was. But I joined the Marine Corps right out of college in 1959, and then as a lieutenant, and then Vietnam came in 65, and I went in there the first time at the end of 1965. And I was commanding Charlie Company, 1st Recon Battalion, working then out of Chu Lai. And then we were running patrols all over I Corps. And I extended twice out there, so I was there two straight years. And we moved our operations as things got hot up at the DMZ toward Da Nang and moved to Da Nang from Chu Lai from the south. And worked that area and all that, and had a wonderful group of Marines running recon patrols all over there, and thoroughly enjoyed that. When I came back, I was hospitalized with hepatitis and some other things. Then I came in the West Coast, was hospitalized, and then sailed off the East Coast to the Mediterranean. I was the operations officer for a BLT. For a number of months.
That's a battalion landing team that goes out with an amphibious unit that sails out. And you'll hear them that they're bringing in a group of Marines and they're on ships, four to five ships. Now it's the Marine Expeditionary Units back then, Marine Amphibious Units.
That's right. Yeah.
Made up of a battalion landing team and an aviation unit and a headquarters unit and a logistics.
That's right. Unit. Could packs a punch. But after the tour out in the Med, came back, and then I got artist to Quantico, and I was had a force recon desk at the development center there with testing new parachutes and new scuba gear, the fun stuff and so on. And then I was there for a couple of years and then selected to be the aide to the commanding general there, who was a Lieutenant General Thrash, who I'm still in contact with. He's retired, 94 years old, in Hilton Head. And he's gone, a wonderful fellow, was an aviator, fought three wars, and Korea was shot down over the Yalu, was a POW for 2 years with the North Koreans. And anyhow, he retired, and then I went to command of staff back to Okinawa, and eventually I was I&I of 4th Force Recon in Honolulu for a couple years, and then I was promoted out of that job and went back to Washington for my first tour as lieutenant colonel back in the late 70s. And I had a originally tour with Manpower, and but I was just there about a year in there, and I got assigned to a special assignment with Central Intelligence Agency, a special operations group. And I was essentially with them for over three years. And I was in Tokyo in 81 when I found out I was selected for colonel. And I had received orders that were already locked in lead for me to go to 2nd Marine Division, where I became the G3 of the 2nd Marine Division, which is...
G3 is heads up all the training.
Operations, training, and planning.
And planning for the whole division.
Yeah. And it's a big job, and I work for a future commandant named Al Gray, and anyone that knows him is... I had G3 on my door, but he was his own G3.
He was his own G everything.
Yes, he did everything. That's right. But I was there, and then I was. He called me in after about 18 months in that job and gave me an opportunity for command. I had a choice between the 8th Marine Regiment and the 24th MAL, a Marine Amphibious Unit, and I took the MAL. It wasn't a question there. And then we were already. Had troops in Beirut, and that's where we sailed with Rev. We went to sail out of there and arrived in May of 1983.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break here, and when we come back, we're going to discuss now that we've landed, or you've landed in Beirut, and all the incidents that happened during that time frame, and even more important is what's happened since then, that a lot of people think this was an isolated incident, and it was not. Carl in the Bot, Free Fire Radio, KCNR 1460.
Hi.
Well, welcome back to Free Fire Radio on KCNR 1460. It's Carl and Linda Bot. Our phone lines here are 605-4567. Our guest is Colonel Tim Garrity, commander of the 24th Marine Amphibious Unit that was attacked in Beirut by suicide bombers. It's had such a... Not only was that a symbolic attack, but it's had significant impact since then. And we left before the break. The colonel had gotten us, taken us into Beirut. So can you follow on to what happened then?
We were the fourth of 5 miles, eventually going into Beirut, and we arrived and immediately picked up the responsibilities of running recon patrols, both foot. On foot and mobile patrols throughout the areas, tying in with the we're the U.S. part of a multinational peacekeeping force. So we had to I had liaison officers and coordinate with our allies, which were the French and the British and the Italians, as well as the Lebanese Armed Forces up at the Ministry of Defense. So we had all over, and as things started to in the summer. We start getting rocket fire and start taking some incoming. And
now, was this at this point after some political decisions been made?
No, it generated it every time the which became a pattern that the government of Lebanon would make an announcement to something that they disagreed with. they voted with Katyusha rockets on our positions. You know, that was just the way they do it over there. You'll find a lot of it is reaction to what was happening, and what was the basic theme is that the negotiations that we were there to provide a stable environment for the diplomats and the politicians and the leaders to work out some kind of resolution to the war. And as time went on, those negotiations became stalled. And looking back, we know at the same time in late 82 and 83, which I say is a game changer, that whole operation, is Iran sent a Islamic Revolutionary Guard contingent, Lebanon contingent, 1,500 men, into Lebanon, into Bekaa Valley, Baalbek, to be specific, where they set up an operational and training camp, which is 26 years later still an active hub of activity. That's where the rockets and things are going in. And Hezbollah, they created, nurtured, financed, and trained Hezbollah that has evolved today to be a proxy army for Iran, directly challenging Israel. And that was the key, that they were on a different schedule. They, Syria, and that's what we found ourselves on a peacekeeping mission with two outside powers, both Syria and Iran.
Their idea was not peace. Their idea was
just the opposite, and we would get goaded into attacks. You know, that we'd have to respond for our own security,
right,
and the security for our diplomats. I ended up having to put special security on the ambassador's quarters up in the foothills. We had special security at the British embassy, because our embassy, a month before we arrived there, was destroyed with a car bomb. It was a van bomb, really, that destroyed it and killed 63 people, including 17 Americans. And the agents, the outfit that took the biggest hit when they hit our embassy was the CIA.
Yeah, I understood that. I've had friends that were there going through and doing investigative work after that, and talked about that.
They lost their station chief, their deputy station chief, and all the key intelligence officers were all killed. But the biggest loss was a visitor from Langley named Robert Ames, and he was the CIA's national intelligence officer for the Near East, the NE. Very prestigious. And he was killed because he just happened to be there on a visit. And he was killed in that bombing and was later eulogized by Director William Casey of the agency as being as close to an irreplaceable man that we had.
Well, now, it appears that this was obviously a well-thought-out plan. They knew where to aim the van at. And was there any thought at all that they knew Ames was there? That, you know, they were waiting just to pull the trigger?
Yeah, that's been looked at, I think, a lot of different ways, you know, that because of that. But it was over lunch hour, you know, I mean, they were working over lunch hour, training mm-hmm. and so on and all this. And he was very well connected. And whether they knew it or not is speculation. It's I got the impression it was a chance.
Okay. Well, all right. So then we've been hit by the embassy real hard, or the embassy been hit real hard, and then you're having to react to all this as a commander does. And,
that's right.
And also not only react to the situation on the ground, but anything that's coming to you, directions.
Key dates. July 20th, the Israelis announced their intention to withdraw from the greater Beirut area and the Shuf. Mountains that are the mountain range that is east of our positions, overlooking Beirut.
Uh-huh.
And they were going to vacate those and move south to the Iwali River, right north of their border. They announced that on July 20th. On July 22nd, we got, again, a barrage of Katyushas from the Druze in the mountains overlooking Beirut. And that was their answer, you know, again, reaction to a move. a key event, the next key event, really. We were taking sporadic fire and so on through the summer. And then on September 4th, the Israelis withdrew from the greater Beirut area. And there was a glitch because we're trying to get the Lebanese armed forces to have a transfer. When the Israelis withdrew from those strategic positions overlooking Beirut and BIA, which was where our headquarters was, is that wasn't coordinated. So when the Israelis left and headed south, that began the predictable, what became known as the September Mountain War, vicious fighting among the Muslims, militias against the Lebanese armed forces to man those strategic positions that the Israelis had vacated.
And you were down, when you said BIA, that's Beirut International Airport, is where you all were staged out of.
That's right. And that was one of the things that was probably foremost in my mind at this whole thing was the deterioration of security in Beirut throughout Lebanon, but particularly focused in Beirut. And when that war started, so on, is the deterioration of security, and we were in very vulnerable position at BIA, at Beirut International Airport.
And we're going to have to take a quick break here. Our guest is Colonel Tim Garrity. We're talking about the events leading up to October 23rd and the bombing of the barracks at Beirut. Colonel in the Bot, Free Fire Radio, KCNR 1460.
It's
Welcome back to Free Fire Radio. KCNR 1460, Carl on the Bot. This portion of the show brought to you by Tobacco and Brew, 2143 Hilltop Drive. Find us walk-in tobacco humidor in the North State. Joe and Shelley do a lot for this city and this county.
And the
great
veterans.
Great coffee. And the veterans. So that's Tobacco and Brew. So much more than a tobacco emporium. Okay, going back to our events and the significant events leading up to the attack on the barracks. Colonel Tim Garrity is our host. Continue on, sir.
Well, the Israelis withdrew, and security is never the same after that. The fighting in the mountains was vicious. We were resupplying the Lebanese armed forces, and it quickly focused on a small resort town in the mountains called Sukhogarb, where the 8th Brigade of the Lebanese armed forces was trying to hold on to and with attacks from the multiple Muslim and Druze forces. It got to a point on September 10th. I received presidential authority through via the Joint Chiefs of Staff that if, in my judgment, the Sukhogarb was in danger of falling, I was authorized to provide direct support to the Lebanese armed forces at Sukhogarb in the with a naval gunfire and our airstrikes. In my orders, it explicitly excluded the use of Marine ground forces. Also in those orders was that nothing in the orders will be construed as changing the mission. It was still a mission. The problem is that it's contradictory.
Yeah, you go from, now you've just taken sides.
That's exactly. I mean, when you're on a peacekeeping mission, you have to maintain your neutrality and impartiality. Those are the tenets of a peacekeeping mission. Here, we're going on the offense and taking sides, so there was a definite conflict there.
Can I jump in just for
R.C. Anselmo?
Some turf builder. It's very interesting to hear commanders review situations like forensically. For us, nobody on the ground that I knew ever considered themselves a peacekeeper. There wasn't any peace. We've talked, the colonel and I, afterwards. We don't think peacekeeping missions are worth a damn. They shouldn't go on. You're inevitably committed to a battle. Also, at this time, while this is all going, nobody should have the impression that, all this was being seen, like, from the safety of a submarine with a periscope. There was so much fire coming in our lines, directly engaging us, like it or not, on a daily basis. there wasn't any impartial way to return fire, you know.
Well, you know, people seem to forget that it's hard to remember you're on a peacekeeping force when the tracers are intersecting on your position,
right.
You know. So
That's right.
We've got just, about another minute here, so we want to keep going, but we're going to have to break here.
For Fox News, but we'll be back for the next hour.
Right. So,
all right. So after I had the presidential authority, I started getting a lot of calls from people wanting me to cut loose with that. And by this time, we had a big armada off the coast, not only U.S. ships, but French aircraft carriers. I had a carrier group over the horizon and all this, and to use that. And I was reluctant to use that simply because our vulnerable position. We were hanging out there. We were in a static location for over a year, which is, flies against all tenets of the Marine Corps, in an active international airport on the low plains and surrounded by artillery coming in from around us.
Let me break right there, because we've got about 30 seconds left. So, you know, it sounds somewhat like a untenable position that you were being put in at that point, Colonel. And it was just starting to ramp up. Our guest is Colonel Tim Garrity, who commanded the 24th Marine Amphibious Unit in Beirut in October of 1983 that was attacked. It's had severe ramifications ever since then. We're going to take a break for the Fox News. Carl Lindebach, KCNR 1460, clearly. News Talk Radio.
This is KCNR Shasta Redding.
Welcome back to Free Fire Radio. KCNR 1460. It's Carl and Linda Bott. Our phone lines here are 605-4567. If you got a question for Colonel Garrity, please give us a call at 605-4567.
We're always taking your emails, Linda, at kcnr1460.com, if you have a question for the colonel. It's going to be high today with a 74, low, mid-40s, currently 52 degrees outside. Today's the day to go out and stretch your limbs, embrace the day. Weather is always brought to you by Anselmo Vineyards.
Colonel, okay, we're as we left our last segment, and we were in Beirut. Marines were at Beirut International Airport, which was just a great place to be located. It was a static position with the hills overlooking you. I'm sure that this probably played a lot into some of the decisions that you were making. Also, the fight was going on for the control of the mountains.
That's correct. And first, it was an abominable tactical position to be in. It was selected a year earlier. When it was a permissive environment, you know, totally different. And that was probably the biggest change in the mission, is that how fast security during the September war deteriorated. And I have to say that we were, the other members of the multinational force, the British and the Italians and the French, were just as vulnerable. We were all hanging out there. But as the September war kept, I kept on getting a lot of calls to unleash this firepower, and I was reluctant because of the vulnerability of our position and losing that the peacekeeping. And so it became a mission creep pretty fast. And finally, on the 19th of September, we were getting reports from Suco Garb that they were massing for an attack. They were moving tanks from a from a staging area to a main attack. Horrendous preparation fire on the LAF, the 8th Brigade, and I had given authorization early in the summer, when the winds of war start creeping in, to put out my radio detachment group and teams in the hills to have increased my intelligence. And I was getting feedback from them that clearly showed that the tactical Syrian armed forces were involved in that attack, along with Druze and multiple Muslim militias. But interestingly, again, getting Farsi intercepts, which we know now that the Revolutionary Guard contingent was part of that attack. And so I finally gave the authorization for naval gunfire support when they came to and it met the tenets of my orders, that Suco Garb was in danger of falling. and that it was a foreign force, and that the government of Lebanon had requested assistance. So we had four naval ships positioned off the port of Beirut, and they opened up with 360-odd rounds and broke the back of the attack. When I did that, though, I mentioned to my staff that my gut instinct tells me that the Corps is going to pay in blood for this, because we were just drifting too far astray from what the mission was. And it worked in as far as breaking that attack. But we essentially had become a party in the combat forces. But the point is that this was all orchestrated by Iran and Syria, you know, that we had to respond for our own protection, protecting diplomats and so on. And this was part of it. So you're in a loser's game, is what I call
it. Yeah, it ceased being a civil war, and now it was just, other nations coming in and involving.
What's interesting is on the 26th, just a week later, on the 26th of September, a ceasefire was worked out by the diplomats between President Assad and President Jamal. His older brother was the president-elect that was assassinated. It brought the Marines back in. That's another story. But they had the ceasefire to terminate the September war. The same date as the ceasefire, NSA got an intercept, diplomatic cable intercept, from the Iranian Ministry of Information and Security, which is the Iranian intelligence service, to their ambassador, the Iranian ambassador in Damascus, a known terrorist, to, quote, take spectacular action against the American Marines at Beirut International Airport. We got hit 28 days later, and that cable got stuck in the intelligence channel. We found out about it in our chain of command 2 days after the attack. October 23rd. So as we moved into October, we were taking very accurate sniper fires. The Syrians have actually moved troops across our wire there at BIA. I was pulling back some of our outposts, and we were just hunkering down. And everyone was very optimistic, because part of the negotiations for the ceasefire is that they agreed. All the factions agreed to meet with the government of Lebanon for the national reconciliation talks in Geneva at the end of the month. And, of course, looking back on it, with the intercept cable, Iranian and Syrian said they had made the decision. They had to hit us before those national reconciliation talks. They weren't going to take any chance. So comes the morning of October 23rd, which is a Sunday morning. I was up at dawn as usual, and I went down to downstairs to my combat operations center and checking the overnight traffic. I walked outside and greeted some Marines. Some were coming off duty, others going to duty, some were working out. It was Sunday, so we had a modified routine on Sunday where we pushed back reveille an hour to 6:30 and then had a brunch between 8 and 10 o'clock. It was very looked forward to by a lot of the young Marines, have a good meal and so on. So I had gone back up to my office, and then at 0622 exactly, enormous blast rocked and blew out windows of my office, sandbags into them, and then followed by these enormous ground shock waves. The entry door to my office, which was a little over 100 meters behind the target, which was the BLT, the Battalion Landing Team headquarters, the entry door to my office was blown off its hinges, and the door frame bent. And, of course, my ears were ringing, and I grabbed my weapon and headed down a very wobbly staircase to the COC, where all the comm equipment had been blown off the shelves and debris still coming down. And some Marines didn't look like anyone was seriously wounded, but I was just trying to figure out what happened. And that's when I had my gut instinct is that we had taken a Syrian Scud missile direct hit. So my ears ringing, I ran outside to find out what happened, only to find myself enveloped in a very heavy gray ash fog with debris still coming down, and you couldn't see the hand in front of your face. So the situations like this generate a lot of confusion and chaos and running around and bumping in. You can't see. Your hearing is all this. And I staggered around literally to the rear of my headquarters. So we had a UN headquarters back there also to find out what happened. And I bumped into literally my logistics officer, who is Major Bob Melton. At the same time, the mushroom cloud was lifting. And the all of a sudden, he turned and he said, "Colonel, my God, the BLT building's gone." And so I'm trying to put all this data through my mind as looking at this. And this was a big, it's one of the strongest buildings in Lebanon, and was literally leveled. And it was a short time later, a Marine came up to me and gave me a quick dump and said that a large Mercedes construction truck had penetrated our southern perimeter, which was from the direction of the main terminal at the airport, and went through our, we had concertina wire and some engineer stakes and the usual things just to keep civilian traffic and auto traffic out of there, out of our positions. And it ran by both two of the outposts through another gate and around some heavy pipes we had laid around that, and angled right into the, through the sergeant of guard. We had sandbag emplacements at the front of the BLT building, which was the sergeant of guard shack that controlled entry into the building, and ran right through that into the building and detonated its load.
Okay, sir, we're going to have to break here for a couple minutes. This is a, you know, I was half a world away in that morning, and the bell started going off for us, too. Carl Lindabot, Free Fire Radio. Our guest is Colonel Tim Garrity, commander of the 24th Marine Amphibious Unit in Beirut in October of 1983. He has written a book about this, but also as we talk about what's happened there and about what has happened since then that are direct results of this attack. Carl Lindabot, Free Fire Radio, KCNR 1460.
Listen up, Redding and...
Well, welcome back to Free Fire Radio, KCNR 1460. It's Carl and Lindabot. Phone lines here are 605-4567. And Bob comes up with more music every time.
Yay.
Yeah, okay. Our guest today is Colonel Tim Garrity, and we were we've been discussing the events that led up to the attack on the Marine barracks, or not the barracks, but where the Marines were barracked at in Beirut, in the 24th Marine Amphibious Unit. All right, sir. When we left, it was they had been hit. The building had been destroyed. If you've got a question for the colonel, I realize you're just like we are here, is listening to the story. But if you have a question, 605-4567. The building's destroyed. You're taking, you know, obviously a commander looking at this is just, no. You know.
Well, you know, the sickening feeling in your gut, because I knew we had over 300 Marines, sailors, and soldiers in that building. We had to move when the artillery and the rockets start coming in. And then getting a report from a Marine at what happened on the penetration of our southern perimeter with this truck. And then I'm thinking of that. Then another Marine came up same time and just said the French got hit. Copycat attack, same way. Truck bomb, unknown casualties, and so on. So my mind was racing with all the confusion and trying to figure out just what in the hell is coming down here. And I asked, what about the Brits? What about the Italians? Are they hit? Is this a prelude to a ground assault? And almost instinct hit me that we're going to get hit again. We were just that. So I grabbed the nearest officer, and I told him the rules of engagement have changed, reinforced the whole perimeter, and stop any vehicle or person trying to enter if they fail to stop, shoot to kill. Grabbed another officer, get the heavy equipment over here. We have to start the rescue operation, recovery operation. We got Marines and sailors under that pile. And I ran back to my headquarters, and I got on my satellite phone to talk to my counterpart, who was Commodore Rick France, who was the commander, essentially, of all of the Beirut. And I could talk directly with him And at the same time, both of us could talk to our boss, who was the Vice Admiral Ed Martin, the commander of the Sixth Fleet, on his flagship somewhere out in the Mediterranean, who incidentally was a POW for 5 years in Hanoi. And so that generated a flash message to BLT headquarters, destroyed, heavy casualties, making French hit, unknown casualties, BLT headquarters destroyed. That was a flash message back to National Military Command Center. A second one followed, which was a, we call a pinnacle front burner, a flash message that I said I needed a replacement of the entire BLT headquarters and an additional infantry rifle company to have security for the follow-on attack site we expected, as well as the recovery operation. And that flash message went, and to their credit, on standby at Camp Lejeune, the Air Alert Force, which is a 24/7 standby, they arrived the next day.
And that's a huge logistical move if anybody knows anything about this, to get it there the next day.
Yeah, those guys, by the way, were not happy. I remember that.
Well, they probably had, other thoughts than ending up in Beirut at that situation.
But that was the situation there. And, of course, we had the, when all was said and done, President Mitterrand of France came, Vice President Bush, General Kelly came. There was a lot of congressional parties, then the Long Commission, the investigations and so on. The recovery and rescue operation lasted 7 days. And the final tally was 240 U.S. and 58 French peacekeepers killed, 299 killed.
And one woman. Did anybody ever get to the bottom of who that woman was?
There was a custodian in the building. That was the lone civilian that we had and so on. And, but when all was said and done, for the Marines, it was the largest loss of life in a single day since D-Day and Iwo Jima, 1945. For the Syrian and Iranian operations plan, putting this together and carrying it out through Hezbollah, through proxies, with the loss of two imported Iranian suicide bombers.
Kind of sounds familiar about something that happened years later in New York.
Well, it's considered now, I mean, historically a seminal event in the beginning, the war in terrorism, where it's the first time the Islamists have hit a significant American target. And Al-Qaeda never had this capability before Mughniya, who was one of the key Hezbollah operatives that, working with Iranian intelligence on the bombing of the barracks in 83. Mughniya met with Osama bin Laden in Sudan in 1996. Right before bin Laden moved to Afghanistan, he was being kicked out of there. Mm-hmm. And they never had, before that meeting, Osama bin Laden stated he was inspired by the bombings in Beirut in 83. Mughniya was tied in with the Iranians to run. And Al-Qaeda used the Beirut truck bombing as their model. When they, on their first operation, was 2 years later, on two simultaneous suicide attacks on the U.S. embassies in East Africa. And then they took that same model and expanded it to the four commercial airline hijackings of 9/11 here in the United States.
And all had the germs right there. It started right there in 1983.
That's, you bet.
Well, sir. Now, Since that, after that tragedy, and I know that a number of things occurred after that, and besides the fact that the our enemies used that as a platform to jump off on other attacks, this war that we're fighting against Islamic jihadists has been going on a long time. And, you know, we can go back to 83, but we can go out back further than that for attacks that have happened. Do you see this as something that will eventually work its way out? Or is this going to be a continual war?
It's a long war. And that's where the danger is, because, you know, half the country doesn't even believe it's a war. You know, that we're, you know, they just, they're looking at it as a criminal activity or something and so on. It's war. And what's interesting is that the fellow who is today the Minister of Defense for Iran, his name is Vahidi, Ahmad Vahidi. He was one of the key, he was the key deputy in the bombings of the Beirut bombings in 1983. He later succeeded and became the commander of the Lebanese contingent in the late 80s. The mullahs promoted him in 1991 for his service there, including the bombing. And he founded and became the first commander of the Revolutionary Guards Quds Force, they call it, Elite Quds Force. He was the first commander and ran it for 10 years. He was the one that has a background of intelligence operations and special operations abroad. He's the one that has the dubious distinction of being on Interpol's most wanted list, the red notices, for running an operation, a special operations abroad, Hezbollah, in destroying the Israeli embassy in Buenos Aires, 1992, and 2 years later, the Israeli-Argentine Mutual Cultural Society, both special operations. He ran those, and that's why he's wanted by Interpol. In August of 2009, he was named the Minister of Defense.
Well, we are talking to Colonel Garrity, and I'm sure many of you who are listening are just in this place because we're getting inside wonderful historical information. We come back after our other hard break. Let's talk about your book and where we can get your book and what you kind of see where we are now as a nation, what we as Americans need to pay attention to.
One of the other things I wanted to talk about too, and we had talked about in the break, is the part your wife played in this after the attack, because this, when it came back to her, she immediately became part of what was going on too. Yes. And and this is where we go back to the families. It's sometimes that we don't understand that it's the Marines out on the front lines, but when something of this magnitude happens, the wives step up, and they have to step up. It was with a tragedy of this magnitude, like this. We've got like 30 seconds. I remember when I said I was a half a world away, that we got that alert, that flash message, and I wasn't on duty that day, and they called me in to take a look at it. And when we did, it was to. And we saw that, and at first it was hard to understand what had happened. How could the whole BLT headquarters be taken out? Because we pictured you in a different situation. And then after the next messages flowed in, you know, the general came in, and everybody was following this. This is Carl Lindebottom, Free Fire Radio. Our guest is Colonel Tim Garrity, former commander of the 24th Marine Amphibious Unit. Join us after these messages.
Meats and groceries.
Welcome back to Free Fire Radio on KCNR 1460. Carl and Linda Bott. Our phone lines here are 605-4567 if you've got a question for the Colonel Tim Garrity. We're streaming at KCNR 1460, and we also, you can write to us at Linda at KCNR1460.com. Colonel, we were just talking at the break about the casualty notification, how that worked. All the records for a lot of Marines and sailors were at the bottom of that pile of rubble. But you all handled it in a good Marine fashion. You explained how everybody was notified. And then, of course, your wife actually played a big part in this, too.
That's right.
Back at Camp Lejeune, there was, of course, a lot of pressure. Wives, families were calling congressional, they're calling their congressmen and so on. The phone system was just overwhelmed. People wanted to know what their, what happened. And we were still trying to dig out underneath where all their records were, both medical records and all this. And finally, AT&T stepped forward, and we got telephone lines, and we started making calls to the survivors, letting them know to the families that they had survived. But, of course, it started, and a lot of people never got that call. My wife, Karen, as the commanding officer's wife and so on, and she and the wives from the wives with her start making calls to the families when we start getting the reports that their husband was killed and so on and all that. And that takes a tremendous drain, emotional drain, because these are friends. You know, these are people we play softball with, you know, and we entertained together. We got to know very good. It was family.
It's family, right. That's mm-hmm. right.
And Karen did a tremendous job. And, in fact, it became, she's become sort of asked for to speak out on this and gave a talk to some wives at Stanford University just last month at their Haas Institute, part of their Haas public service program up there and so on. But it gives a whole side that people don't realize that the wives, when there's a tragedy of this magnitude, how they have to go to each and visit the families and give them support. And I can tell you that we just came back from the 26th Remembrance at the Bay Memorial at Camp Lejeune. We have every October 23rd. And one of the most inspiring stories for me is the families and how they have, we've maintained contact. We put together a directory that they can keep contact with one another and help one another. And how they've picked up the pieces of shattered lives, raising kids themselves. And they come back and you see these kids today that are mature young people. All of them had... Everyone, not only Marine, but sailors and soldiers, everyone had scholarships to college that were given by the Marine Corps Scholarship Fund Foundation. And that to see how they've developed and the irony of how many have become Marines.
Well, it's not an irony. I think that they saw what happened. We've got a phone call in. Gary?
Good morning. Fantastic program. If you could make all the decisions, say from the White House all the way down in a perfect world, what would be what would you do? And I mean, realistically, with the weaponry and the special ops that we have, et cetera, what would you have done, say then, and in your closing out, what would you do now when you do your synopsis? And I'll listen to you on the air. Am I clear? Do I make myself clear?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. First of all, back then, I touch on this in my book, I think we made a severe mistake by not responding to the terrorist attack back. These are acts of war. And we knew who did it. The usual suspects, Iran and Syria, using proxy Hezbollah, not only on the Marine barracks, but also previously on the embassy. And President Reagan wanted to respond. He ordered it to respond, but it got clutched up and never happened. We never did respond. And it is my opinion that by virtue of the fact we did not respond, is that the Islamists felt that they could attack us with impunity, which is exactly what has occurred. This started a cascading worldwide events of mayhem and carnage and murders, torture, kidnappings, all the Americans in Lebanon and other places. Not only Americans, but Westerners, French and British and so on. And I think we paid a price for that. Here we are today, ratchet up. The same people, Vahidi, the current Minister of Defense, and the his predecessor was a guy by the name of Nadjer, Mustafa Nadjer. He was the one that was commander of that Lebanon contingent of the IRGC. He was the Minister of Defense before Vahidi. These two fellows are the ones that are key leaders in marching lockstep on Iran's defiance and deception in getting nuclear weapons. Same fellows.
This nuclear weapon question with Iran, there is no doubt in your mind that if they get this, that they're going to use it.
Absolutely. And that's the danger, because just look at their history. Look at the background. They've never had a weapon they haven't used. And they have accumulated, primarily through Russia, a pretty good arsenal. They have resupplied Hezbollah, the army in Lebanon, with last estimate over 40,000 rockets that are the ones, and missiles that are the ones that are going to rain on Israeli cities if the Israelis attack. But getting a nuclear weapon, we're on a collision course. Western civilization, we are on a collision course with Iran, and it's a question of before they get the bomb or after.
Well, we as Americans, as we're listening to this information, before we got to take a break here, you know, for the individual soul, the individual American, what can we do to not stand by and feel helpless about this? Maybe you can help.
Let's take a break first and answer. That's a good question. Bring hoping, you know, what can we do to stand up and make ourselves stronger? Carl in the Bot, Free Fire Radio, KCNR 1460. Yeah. Welcome back to Free Fire Radio on KCNR 1460. It's Carl in the Bot, clearly News Talk Radio on Free Fire Radio. Our guest is Colonel Tim Garrity. We're in our last 15 minutes of the show. Okay, Colonel, we were talking about that it appears that the Iranians are not slowing down on their quest for a nuclear weapon. Sanctions. What do you think?
How long have we been at it, and what has been their response? And it's not only United States, but the United Nations, the IAEA, the secret facility in Qom, you know, all the different things. It's been literally a thumbing their nose at the international community while they continue to the centrifuges who spin there to make highly enriched uranium for nuclear weapons. So the question boils down to the Israelis. They're going to be the recipient of that. Whether they can wait, and that's what we're coming funneling closer and closer to that. And of course, the great question is at what stage the Iranians are before they get enough highly enriched uranium for the weapons. They're testing missiles into space and others. You can see they're laying out really a bloody plan on what they plan to do when they get it.
It's like watching somebody, making a bomb next door. They're going to throw into your living room, and the question is, and you've been telling everybody, you've been telling the police and telling everybody, at what point do you stop them?
And that's really the point, because in order to take military actions, blockade, hitting the sites, temper whether you can destroy it or not, you can retard it, delay it for a period of time. And who's to do it? The question really boils down to is doing it before they have it or wait until after.
Well, and you, of course, have been working for a number of different agencies, and you have a lot better information than I have. But it seems to me that somebody needs to look at the Israeli mindset after millions being killed during World War II of them. Yeah. That are they going to wait to have something like that happen again to strike, or are they going to prevent that? And that mindset has got to be taken into account.
Absolutely. And you hit on a good point, because the Iranians, the way they shuck and jive that they've been doing the last 25 years with all this carnage and mayhem that they've, as the number one state sponsor of terrorism, and have continued that without a bit abating, is that the idea of attacking Iran and putting sanctions or blockade or military action would likely trigger a lot of things. And see, that's what they threaten, you know, disrupt the oil flow in the Middle East, hit the Saudi refineries, open up their cells here in the United States for attacks and all that. It's war to do that. And that's what they're threatening. And so when you think what president, you know, by not doing anything, you avoid that. But the question is, look forward a year from now or whatever, when they have a nuclear weapon. That's not going to go away. It's going to be a lot more dangerous.
And as we discussed, the Middle Eastern nation, the Arabs, are really frightened of the fact that the Persians getting a nuclear device, because they'll use it against them.
That's right.
At least, you know, if nothing else, blackmailing them for everything.
That's right. And again, to tie in is the two key leaders of that are orchestrating that whole thing for the Revolutionary Guard. And they're the ones running Iran right now with growing strength.
Mm-hmm.
The same ones that were in charge of the bombing of the barracks there and so on. One other point I'd like to bring up is the Hezbollah operating in Latin America and the relationship Iran has now with the growing relationship with Venezuela. And tied in with that, the Russians building plants down there for nuclear, not for nuclear, but for arms plants. And a $5 billion, the latest weapons sale to Venezuela, including military helicopters and so on. And using Hezbollah, that's active in Latin America, still is, been running. They have a working agreement, and this is from our own intelligence, that have a working agreement, Hezbollah, read Iran, to use the same drug cartel routes to import contraband and personnel into the United States. They've been doing that for quite a while.
And which brings us into the part about keeping our borders safe. And that just think, oh, it's just marijuana smugglers and a bunch of poor people that are just trying to find jobs is ludicrous.
I live in Phoenix. And last week, there were a rancher down near Douglas on the border that was killed and so on. And what struck me on that is that it appears that he was killed, they said, by a scout for the cartels. Military tactics. They're putting out scouts before a major move, a major drug move across the border. And they have military scouts, and they think this rancher disrupted a scout. And he was out there on his ATV, you know, with his dog and with weapons that were still there, but never used. And they think he disrupted, found this scout. And they said he went for a cell phone, and they said that's where he was found, shot and all that.
Right. Well, we got to take another break here. But one of the things, if McCain finally stood up and said, I think we need to put troops on the border. And that's the first time McCain has ever said that.
That's right.
So, you know, I think that maybe it's like 20 years too late. But
Carl, can we have some of those troops right here in Shasta County, please?
That's right. You know, we've got a lot of, because if you can tie Hezbollah into the drug traffickers, and these drug traffickers go throughout the United States, which is really the scary thought. Mm-hmm. Carl Lindebaugh, Free Fire Radio, KCNR 1460.
Carl and Lindebaugh. KCNR 1460 AM, clearly News Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Free Fire Radio, KCNR 1460. Our guest is Colonel Tim Garrity. As I'm ringing the bell here by accident, you know, Colonel, we're so happy to be here and that you were here, and you know, proud to have you on the show. We've only got about 5 minutes left. The name of your book is
Peacekeepers at War, and you can get Peacekeepers at War on Amazon. And we would like to invite you to come back to the North State and do a book signing. And maybe we could do it out at Anselmo Vineyards where we...
Certainly. No problem there.
Yeah. And encourage our North State, because I'm sure there's lots of people listening right now that, you know, just don't want to interrupt. It's so... Your information is so rich. And, again, we encourage you to go pick up the book, Peacekeepers at War. Peacekeepers at War, by Colonel Timothy Garrity, and that's G-E-R-A-G-H-T-Y.
It was a stealth spelling there when they go on it. Colonel, we got 4 minutes left. Can you please give us those last thoughts here?
Well, in looking back and where we are today, the threat to the United States, most of my career was in during the Cold War confrontation, and here we have today, few would have realized that this terrorist attack half a world away from the United States with a small peacekeeping force in a faraway land would turn out to be really what has evolved from that event to be the primary threat, national security threat to Western civilization in the 21st century.
It was the initial fuse being lit, and it's just kept going, and it's just kept growing. It's not something that's gotten smaller by any means.
And justice has never been served to the perpetrators. They've played this proxy game and shucking and jiving and threatening and defiance and so on, and are continuing it as we speak. Not only, just listen to their rhetoric, it's almost like goading you to do something.
Yeah, we dare you. Go on. Mm-hmm. What are you going to do about it?
But at the same time, they're buying time, and it's getting, you can see the collision going to be down the road. It's going to be nasty.
It occurred to me that when I was on Paris Island, they used to make us say this prayer, where they went honestly in the squad bay, they'd say, we'd all have to repeat this, bomb Iran, oh my God, bomb Iran. That was 1981. To this day, that prayer has not yet been answered, but it's still the major important desire.
Everybody wants diplomatic ways to move. I mean, everybody wants a diplomacy to work. I mean, putting out more men and women in harm's way. Of course, everybody. I know, if you've been a warrior, that you want diplomacy to work.
Absolutely.
Sometimes diplomacy doesn't work, and you have to take the next step. I just hope that in our current administration that they will do that. I mean, and not do some kind of knee-jerk reaction to something else, but a well-thought-out plan, and execute a well-thought-out plan to stop this. Otherwise, within a decade, there's going to be a horrendous casualties and war, and who knows, maybe nuclear exchange in the Middle East.
To reinforce your point on diplomacy is that, yes, no one prays for the success of diplomacy more than the fighters. And that and it was really our mission that with the casualties that Iran did, the mission that caused is that we were trying to provide an environment for the diplomats to be successful.
We're at the end of our show. Somebody just wrote in and says, can you come back tomorrow?
Can you come back tomorrow? I think what's happening is people are getting educated here in a way that beyond anything that we could ever read in books, because this is really from the horse's mouth. I'd hate to say that, to say goodbye, but
we really appreciate
you
being here, Colonel Garrity, and we will have you back later. We'll do this book signing. We'll have you out at our town hall meeting. We can't thank you enough for you appearing today and also for your service to our country.
Thank you very much. It's been my honor.
Carl in the Bottom, Free Fire Radio. It's the good guys against the bad guys. Which are you?
This is KCNR, Shasta Redding.